So here we are at the end of the first year of post the Arwen program. Mm-hmm. See what I mean? So you've done the Arwen program, now a year on, having done whatever you've done. So I guess one of the questions really around, I don't know, this whole area is how does it travel in your lives? You know, and it's in a certain sense that when we're just doing the Arwen training, it's a monthly meeting where we've got this poem we keep on coming back to and working with in all kinds of different ways. And, you know, it's a program and there's good bits about it and not so good bits, I guess, but the sort of question that we sit with now and maybe always is, what is the point of this stuff? You know, and the particular point for you here and now, as opposed to the point that would have been there a couple of years ago or last week. There's something about, okay, what are we doing here? At the heart of all this stuff, at the heart of the poem, at the heart of a lot of this, a lot of these old stories, whether it's the search for the grail or the search for the heart desire, it's the search for something that has a mysterious life, that is like the green that Rob was talking about, that is self-generating. The thing about the Grail and the Grail stories, it's never described. Nobody ever knows. I mean, we've got people that assume the Grail is the cup or the cauldron, but actually the Grail story is that the Grail is never ever described. Nobody ever knows what the Grail is. They know it by its effects. So one of the effects of the Grail is you are nourished by the Grail. That you are given exactly the right food for you, that the most tasty food in all the world, that is very particular to you, and everybody is served by the Grail, they're given something different. The other thing the stories talk about really is they take us into a world, a connected world, but also a world where there are these powerful kind of beings, whether it is Isabel Gowdy or Thomas Reimer or Arthur or Guinevere. We enter into a kind of a world of living story that intersects with the story of our own lives, if we let it. There's been a great example of this on TV a little while back. There's been a dramatization of a story of a book called Mr. Strange and Mr. Norrell. I don't know if anybody has seen them. Yeah, Mr. Norrell. And it's a fascinating. The book is actually better than the film. But the TV thing was actually a very good presentation of the book, I thought. And what's interesting about this book, it took the author 10 years to write it, and she's at work on another one, and I think we're about 10 years in, so with any luck she'll produce something else over the next couple of years. Is at one level it's a Georgian Jane Austen novel, comedy of manners and very formal and the other thing it's about is the return of magic to England. And there's a whole, the book begins with a whole lot of stuff about how there are magicians still in England, but they are theoretical magicians, because nobody practices magic anymore. And there are these amazing stories of the Raven King, who is the king in the north, who went into fairyland and was fostered in fairyland, and who set up an alternative kingdom, magical kingdom. But the king has long gone, and the magicians of the golden age are long gone. And what you now have are just theoretical magicians who can't do any magic. And the story begins really with the meeting of a learned society in York of theoretical magicians. And a really unpleasant practical magician called Mr. Norrell, who is engaged in buying up all the books of magic that he can find, and then because he's very acquisitive. But he's different from the theoretical magicians in that he has just worked out how to do practical magic. And he does this sort of deal with the theoretical magicians of York, that if he demonstrates to them that practical magic is indeed possible in this age, that they will acknowledge that he is the only magician in England, and they'll all stop pretending to be magicians. And there's a wonderful, wonderful scene in the film where he actually gets the statues of York Minster to speak, and of course they all have to decide they're not real magicians, and therefore he is the only magician in England. But of course he becomes not the only magician in England, because somebody else called Mr. Strange who also discovers a way to be a magician. And Mr. Strange is a completely different kind of magician from Mr. Norrell. Mr. Norrell's magic comes out of books and understanding and he's a powerful magician, but Mr. Strange does it all intuitively through his body and through his imagination and by linking with the earth. And the film shows this very, very powerfully. You've got sort of Noel is doing all these incantations and studying in books, and you've got Strange plunging his kind of hands into the earth and somehow working with his imagination and the natural kind of energies. And actually, by the end of the book, they sort of make friends with each other all kinds of complicated things go on before that. But the thing that happens in the book is that the Raven King is summoned back to England. And the thing that happens in that, the Burial of Mr. Norrell, is that as part of the price of summoning the Raven King back, all his books vanish. Everyone. So he's completely stripped bare of all the stuff that he's accumulated. And it's not quite a cliffhanger, because the story is kind of in the book is wrapped up quite well, really. But you have this sense of, oh my God, now the Raven King is out, and the roads of the Raven King, which are the roads through the mirror, so you can step through mirrors, find yourself in this magical place where you can travel from place to place and find the old places of magic. And now the roads are now open. The other subplot in the book is that Norrell, who brings somebody back to life and uses and the whole thing about Norrell is that he believes nobody should use fairy magic anymore, and he's got a new magic that he wants to show everybody. But his new magic cannot bring somebody back to life, so he does a deal with a fairy, and the fairy tricks him and brings somebody back to a half life and imprisons somebody. So the other theme of the book is the freeing of people out of fairyland. Now, in a way, this is a very interesting book. So it's a really, if you haven't read it, and if you'd have to kind of like Jane Austen type novels, because it is written in that sort of style, but although it's also kind of quite fantastical. But if you like that kind of book and you haven't read it, I really recommend you read it. It's wonderful. It's good. The author is stunning. She's because it's got all kinds of footnotes about the magicians of the past age, and so it's really written in that kind of, you know, that very formal style that Jane Austen is to write in, and so. But what the book's kind of interesting, because it's looking at different kinds of magic, and it's looking at, well, does magic exist? Does magic not exist? And what is magic? And the two powerful themes of the book, in a way, are the magic that is given into books or resides in books, and the perilous nature of dealing with fairy. And then this powerful image of the Raven King, who is this sort of mischievous, mercurial kind of spirit. Now, it's sort of interesting talking about this even, really, while we've got a big, you know, sort of stage magic show in town. Because one of the big questions about magic is magic real? and stage magicians are doing something real. Is it true? And it's not true, of course, because they would completely say that. They intend to misdirect you. The art of stage magic is to be misdirected. It's as though you don't notice what they're doing. So it's a completely different kind of energy and sense that you get, for example, from Thomas Reimer, who speaks with the tongue that cannot lie, who can only relate to truth.
So we could call that stage magic. It's a hocus pocus. It isn't really magic.
That's right. No, it isn't. That's right. And hocus pocus itself is interesting because the word hocus pocus comes from the Latin Mass originally. Hoc est corpus meum. This is my body. It's that solemn act in the center of the Mass where the bread and the wine are turned into the body and the blood of Christ. So it's an act. So that even that very phrase hocus pocus originally is an act of transformation, but hocus pocus, as we understand it now, is the pretense of transformation. So, in a way, this whole thing cuts to the heart of our subject. What is true here? What enables transformation? When does something move from hoc est corpus meum to just being hocus pocus? And you find similar things. The word abracadabra is a good one. You know, that's another such word like hocus pocus. Abracadabra, maybe you know, stage magicians will say. Comes originally probably from an old Aramaic phrase, which means I create by the power of the name. So it comes from an ancient kind of source connecting with creativity and life energy. But it becomes a manipulation and eventually a sort of well, a lie, really, a pretense. And in some ways, the one of the key things about the sort of work that we're doing is the capacity to see past the illusion of magic to find real magic. Get it shown for you first in Shakespeare's play The Tempest, where Prospero, the great magician figure, who uses his arts of magic to manipulate, to ensnare, to bind, to get revenge, you know, but also to try and free himself from where he is. Right at the end of the play, he does this powerful and mysterious thing. He gives the island to Caliban. He lets Ariel, his spirit servant, free. He drowns his book of spells and breaks his staff of magic. And these are the tools, these are the beings he's used throughout the whole of the play to achieve his ends. And he says, I have this rough magic I now abjure. I'll break my staff, I'll drown my book 10 fathoms deep. And then at the end of what he then goes to do is to contemplate death. He goes back to Florence. Florence? I can't remember which of the key, whatever, back to Italy anyway. And he spends his time contemplating death, and he ends the play with this great phrase, we are such stuff as dreams are made of. We are poor players strutting on the stage for but an hour, and then our day is done. So what happens then when we drown our books, break our staffs, set our familiar spirits free? You get a similar kind of a thing in the Grail stories. Right, the last test before the Grail comes is you come to the ruined chapel where, you know, you've done this enormous search, lots of quests, achieved lots of things, and you finally found a place after long searching, after a lifetime of searching, you find the place. And actually it's a ruin. And you search and there's nothing there. Nothing at all. And that's the interesting moment, really. That's the moment of choice. Now you can see it in the Mr. Norrell story where in order for real magic to really come back, he has to lose the thing he's been building up all these years. All of it, every book.
So how's the ruined chapel a choice?
Well, the choice is what you do then, okay? So you're there, what do you do with that? So there's various choice points at that moment, okay? And when you're sitting there in a moment where everything has gone, there's various things you could decide at that point. You could decide, well, actually, the Grail is this symbolic thing inside me. I really have the Grail now. I expect that was the whole point to get me here, to realize I was the Grail all along. You could decide that. Could decide any number of things, but actually what is required there is to choose to be with the sense of desolation, dissolution.
What I'm noticing as you're speaking is it's like you're speaking two levels.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a part of me that's kind of going, yeah, I can get that, and there's another part of you going, no idea what you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, exactly. Good. That's right.
It's like it feels like you're saying something really important.
Yeah.
And I can't get it.
No.
And then at another level, it's like, oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
And it's exactly these two levels, right? That's beautifully put, really, because that's exactly these two levels. Well, of course, we're familiar with this kind of language. Okay, so part of us gets it, and part of us doesn't at all. You know, it's the bit in the Thomas Reimer thing where he goes over the hill. We don't know what happens there. Right? You know, we know all kinds of things about that, but we know he comes back when they're with all these abilities. But what happens over the hill? We've no idea. What happens in the after the ruined, you know, in the ruined chapel? Well, I don't know. Nobody knows. What is the Grail? No one knows.
And is that also something of it's an experience? So I'm curious about, is it an experience that happens at depth, below language, and when you try to then put language to it, it somehow confuses it?
Yeah.
Or something like that.
It's something like that, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. It is like that. There's something about being able to tolerate. Because what happens is a simulacrum of that. Because if you can't tolerate that absence of language, absence of knowing, absence of form, what normally happens is you create your own image and words for that. That actually then stops you ever getting there again.
What's a simulacrum?
A simulacrum is an image that's a copy. It's like a copy of the actual experience.
Right.
Yeah, that's language,
because that's a secondary
experience. Yeah, that's right, and it's how we use language. It's not just language, it's like we can use a sense of image as well to do with that, but language really helps with it. So there's something about that, you know, that if we're going to speak at all, the words have to come almost unbidden. Right, so to talk about this at all is genuinely impossible, right? So, but the more consciously we try to wrap words around the experience, the less true it is.
We're just labeling.
Well, yeah, and the labeling then gets in the way because we think we know, you know. And the thing is, it's so bloody subtle, this stuff, because we know this language of knowing and not knowing, right? We've worked in it a long time, worked in it for years, maybe working it in with clients and things. But actually, the real of it is, it's really to know that we don't know does us in. You know, it really... Oh, what? No, that can't be true. So we're talking about something that's really kind of difficult, and you know, there's all these stories, ideas, and we looked at loads of things, and they're good things, but the place they take us to, when we follow them, is, you know, the best you can do in some ways is get that phrase, well, it's over the hill. You know, in a way, the best use of language like this is these, in a way, quite literal sounding things. It's over the hill and you can't see it. Now, you could talk about super consciousness but that's more difficult in some ways. I think that the old stories try and do the best, are actually some of the most accurate things, because they say, well, no, it's the other world, or it's over the hill, or it's a, you know, they're phrases that sound kind of childlike. But actually, they're more accurate than the more cognitive expressions of these things. And what's interesting, I think, is that if you look at the collective awareness, these versions of these stories keep being told, you know, and they even get into TV, you know, there's not often, admittedly. But, you know, if I think of the Strange and Normal TV series, it's completely addressing our kind of subject. It's stunning and miraculous to me that her book got published, because the book Strange and Normal is massive. It's a massive novel. It was published by a mainstream publisher. It's done incredibly well all over the world. And I think she had luck and good contacts, but it's not the sort of thing the publishers normally publish. But there's something about the power of these things that they keep on retelling themselves.
That's the Green Chapel.
Yeah.
Go back to the Green Chapel.
Okay. The thing about the Rear-End Chapel and why the Rear-End Chapel is essential is it takes you into it absolutely faces you with the necessity of having to give up or make something of it, because actually the reality of on the Grail quest of finding the Rear-End Chapel is not only have you not found the Grail, still no idea what it is. There's no nice little antiques to take back with you that you can say, well, I've gone there, you know, this is what I found on the quest. So the only thing to do, if you're going to try and stay, is to be in the ruins.
Be in the what?
In the ruins of the chapel, right? To really sit with it, to be with it, and kind of, and be with the failure of the quest. You know, that in a way to be over the hill, not knowing. You know, it's said to be and in the Grail stories that they say, this is the last test. If you can really be with this, you will find the Grail, or you come away with the false Grail, pretend Grail.
I don't know why this feels relevant.
Go on.
Because it feels like it's about magic.
Yep.
But it's, thank you, Robert. I've been a bit obsessed about Greece and what's happening in Greece and what's happening with the EU and the power thing.
Yeah.
And that feels like there's two levels to it.
Yeah, go on.
There's the
Well, there's the kind of media political thing, and then there's underneath, which is like the dark crystal skull, some kind of magic that's going on there.
Yeah.
And there's loads of conspiracy theories, aren't there, about the New World Order? And,
yeah.
Really what they're trying to do is to just take over, so they're creating chaos.
Yeah.
In which everybody would feel most terrified in order to do what they want.
Or be able to do, yeah. Mm.
Which is a kind of spell, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
A magical spell.
Totally, yeah.
Mm. And I'm curious about how I've been really obsessed with it and focusing on certain characters. And the one character that I've really focused on is Farrah Fakkus, who I think is just this person saying, the Emperor's got no clothes on.
Yes, totally, yeah.
And he's being, you know, it's just to this... And that feels like that's that kind of territory.
Yeah,
sorcerer magic territory that we're seeing right in front of our eyes.
No, absolutely is that, isn't it? Because actually, what the Greek government did, what the Greek people did as well, is to say, look, this is ridiculous. This is a sort of spell that's been cast upon everybody, and this notion of austerity, that actually it is a construct. You know, it's a construct. It's a magical spell in some ways. And it's sort of interesting for me that it comes out, if you think archetypally for a moment, this comes out of Greece, which is the place of the demos. It's the place where the idea of democracy comes from, which is this idea of rule by the people. And of course, which has been taken and done, all kinds of things have been done to it. And I've just been sort of interested in that, so I've equally been really interested in it. And you've got a lot of these scenes of Athens and with the Acropolis and the Temple of Athena, so there's something about this kind of, it's this extraordinary kind of image of the goddess Athena, who is the goddess of wisdom and the teacher goddess, who teaches the heroes. Her temple is somehow sitting in the middle of this experience. And there's something here about this idea of spells, and it's just interesting that we're sitting with the kind of stage magicians this weekend who will be, because that's a spell, this sort of stage. I actually love stage running; it's fun, but actually what they rely on is deceiving you. Okay, they rely on misdirecting you, trying to persuading your senses that something is happening that isn't happening.
Deep corruption is everywhere.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen here.
No, it's right. Because, yeah. No, it's massive here.
It's deeper and more complicated because we don't see it at all. It seems as if
Britain is one of the centres of the global finance industry. Right? There's no doubt about it. If we look at the international politics, Britain is not a country that produces that much anymore. But it is one of the major centres of international finance and banking. So if there is a place in the world where a lot of that corruption is endemic, it's here. I mean, there's little doubt about it for some reason. And there's just something about that energy of truth. It is that tongue that cannot lie, that somehow we're seeing playing out there. And that, and there's lots of layers to it. I mean, there's some extraordinary things going on. Germany is bullying Greece. This is Germany, sort of Second World War, invaded Greece, dominated it, is now economically... So there are all these strange things coming out, being revealed, powerful dynamics. It did. Yes, exactly. So Germany was massively thrown a lifeline in order to, partly because the Allies wanted to build Germany up as a bulwark against the Russians in the Cold War. So that was part of it. But in a sense, the thing that happened to them, they're not willing to extend to Greece.
But also, it's that thing of it shows how difficult the choice is.
Yeah.
So you see
totally.
Greece in this kind of choice.
Yeah.
And I really identify that in my own life.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got this choice, and one is going down a route which is following a path that feels right, and there's no guarantee of anything,
it's totally that, exactly that.
You see that with Greece, and then you entity that they've chosen to enslave themselves.
Yep.
They probably didn't have much choice.
No, I don't think they
did. They didn't have any choice, but it was like, you know, and I can see how I enslave myself in certain constructs or, you know, and it's like, it does feel like it's an impossible choice.
It is, and it is exactly that, that you end up in a totally complicated place around freedom and imprisonment. You know, so that's the place that it takes you to. And what, if you like, the great magicians would say, what Thomas Reimer would say is, well, you know, you've just got to go over the hill. Or Prospero would say, you do have to break your staff and drown your book. But of course, it's an impossible, if we think of it in the context of Prospero, he has only been able to live because of his staff and his book and his familiar. It's like he has to get rid of everything that has supported him.
So what leads him to that? Is it a kind of desperation?
No, the interesting thing about in the Prospero thing, he has he has made peace with everybody. He has achieved his objectives, and his daughter and the son of his enemy actually. So there's it's a very powerful play, this, an archetype play, and where there is an alchemical marriage really between the son of his enemy and his own daughter. So somewhere he resolves the play begins really with him having been betrayed. Duke of Milan, that's what it's Milan, not Florence, where he is betrayed and overthrown by his own brother. So there's a sort of profound kind of betrayal, and he's isolated on this island, and in a way, part of the problem is that the reason he could be betrayed, he became very obsessed by his study of magic and didn't pay attention to outer relationship, and so ended up isolated and marooned on an island with his daughter, and then he finally, he enchants the spirit Ariel, and he enchants Caliban, who's this kind of monstrous kind of figure, who's the son of the witch who owns, who's now dead but wants to own the island. And he uses his magic to lure his enemy onto the island with his son and family. And there's a whole kind of, and he's this sort of puppet master, kind of manipulating everything. But the thing that happens that he couldn't have foreseen is that his daughter falls in love with the son of his enemy. And the thing that stops it just being a revenge story, and where he just feels here, is because he can't bear to destroy his daughter's happiness. So so something in him has to give way. So that's the place where he starts to give way, and then peace is made somewhere. And it's at that moment then, see, that he has this kind of choice in himself about whether to break his staff, whether to give away his power and enter into something deeper. The nature of love, exactly that. We're talking about the nature of love and the nature of death, right? So it's love that enables him to do that, and it takes him into the experience of death and transformation. So in that moment, there is something beyond himself, and that's the point, in a way, that moment when you're sitting in the ruined chapel, you really can't do it. It's something beyond you, which is normally an aspect of love that somehow comes in, that somehow enables you to do whatever it is that is necessary, even though you don't know what is necessary. The whole thing about, you know, our mind, I can think, there's a sort of part of me thinking, what should we do in the ruined chapel? What do we do? The thing is, you can't do anything at all. You have to stop doing or thinking and it's the most awful place in some ways, and yet it's the place of possibility.
There's a children's book that we had, it's always really important to me. Nobody else. I think, anyway, it's called The Outside Cat, and this is this cat, this is sort of scatty old tabby called The Outside Cat, And there is also an inside cat who's a sort of Persian. And so this family has two cats, basically.
Inside cats
spend their entire life trying to get in to the house. Like, and occasionally cat manages to sneak past somebody's feet. And his boot comes going, out, you are the outside
side
cat.
And
then this Persian sort of sitting there.
Looking smug.
One day he does actually, you never see a human in it, or you see a human, it's a bit like Tom Jones. Brilliant, Mr. Jones. He managed to get into the house. Then he gets in, he finally he's got his last of it, he's inside the house. Everything's going, moving, and everything's gone, so he's there in an empty house. I think I might have said this before, but but then people move in and they go, oh, this is really nice. This, I'm missing the dramatic impact of this, but anyway, it's like, this is lovely. The cat, and it's such a nice house. And there's a, look, it's so happy with the cat here already. And there's a yellow vase with red berries in it, and they like the flowers, and the cat is going. So, but there is this bit in the middle where he's finally got this last foundation that he's in the house. Empty.
That's the same. That's exactly it. That's exactly. That's lovely description. But of course, does he become the inside cat of the new home? Brilliant.
They only have one cat.
Now that's the better thing, right? So he's the inside Anna, and that's a great. That's a great depiction of what I'm describing, right? Because he
can go in and out. Right?
Yeah, like, that's right.
Kind of normal relationship.
Yep, that's right.
Weird people with
yeah.
Have an inside cat.
Outside cat, it is, that's right. But that's great, right? Because actually, that's exactly the Ruin Chapel experience. That's beautiful way of describing it, right? So he achieves his ambition, he gets in there, and it's empty. There's nothing there. And then something happens. Something unexpected, you know, it's terrible. But no, poor bloody cat, he's been trying for all this time. Oh my God. And then something mysterious happens, something entirely unexpected. So then, as you say, there's just the one cat. He can be outside and inside. And he couldn't have predicted that and couldn't have known that.
His Holy Grail is the only thing letting go of him now.
That's right.
So
that's
the Holy Grail for me would be enlightenment or a dropping away of ego. He doesn't need to struggle anymore. He doesn't need to think.
Well, he's in a totally new paradigm now, isn't he? So something is but the thing is, he can't have known that in it. That's why it's such a brilliant story. It's a really perfect story. He can't have known that in it because those conditions didn't apply. And in a way, so he's got to keep doing his thing, right? Until something changes but the change, you know, at that point he could have run away and found another house or something and been disillusioned and disappointed. But actually, he just has to stay there. And actually, conditions around him change.
So he allowed the desolation.
He did. So he sits with the kind of the, you know, it isn't at all what he wanted or expected.
And the space is created to allow something to come
out. It is, but even using those words, you see, that's why Siobhan's right about. We sort of think we know this because we have a we do have a language that helps us cope with this, and it's never it.
Yeah.
Okay, the language always slightly takes us away, because of course this is relentless part of us that keeps trying to make sense.
Yeah.
Right. That's that internal dialogue where we keep on trying to assimilate the experience of something that is beyond assimilation. Completely, yeah, naturally. It's a bit like, you know, when you describe, you know, I know what I want to do, but oh my God, can I make any money out of it? And will I just go to hell? It's that place where you somehow want to find a safety within that rather than, understandably. But of course, trying to do that, or any attempts to do that, fail. Or if they succeed, they create something different from what was intended. I mean, my experience of becoming a therapist was like this. I've probably told you this story, must have told you this story before. I had one client fairly immediately, then I didn't have another client for 2.5 years. And in that 2.5 years, I did everything I could to get people. I advertised, I did this, I did that, I did, you know, I networked like buggery, I did all the things that you're supposed to do, absolutely all the things that you're supposed to do. And then I had to just at the end, well, I just came to the end, partly it took me a long time because I'm very determined and very controlling. So I just kept on and kind of, and eventually I just had to give up, and that was when clients started to come. And the thing is, the danger of that is you can just turn it. I can turn it into a theory, or you've just got to get to the point where you give up. But actually, you can't give up. You can't give up until you give up. You can't make something happen. Surrender, in particular, is something you just can't make yourself surrender.
You are surrendered.
Yeah, if something happens to you, okay, you just have to keep on. In a certain way, you just you keep on with your quest until...
Surrender's different from giving up, isn't it? It's a different thing.
No, I don't think it is. I actually think really giving up is... I think we like to use the word surrender because it's easier than giving up. Actually, it's giving up, you know, sort of... Because when you really give up, you're really helpless. You know, surrender always sounds a bit nicer, I think. You know, because it just sounds, you know, it sounds more spiritual.
I just don't mind anymore.
Yeah. Well, you do mind. You think
nothing in the surrender. You just don't mind anymore.
In surrender.
Yeah. I think so. Giving up. I think there is. I remember trying to get onto BCPC course. And
yeah.
I had a frightful interview, and then I went to see the Richard therapist, who was the head of the training. And I hadn't had the letter to tell me I wasn't going to get in, and all of that. Getting very dramatic in this session, and oh well, never mind. I came away, I went home, had a bloody mess to say I got onto the course.
Oh, kidding.
And I just thought, I just don't care. it doesn't matter, I don't need to go on the course anymore.
Is this true?
You've done a course.
Already done the course, that's right. Yeah.
And I just said,
that's it. No, that's it. That's exactly it. That's it.
I've gone through the.
Yeah.
Just as a matter. I don't mind anymore. I should never have gone on the damn course.
Yes. Well, there is that. as we know. Yes, that's very good.
I didn't take my own advice. Anyway,
that's good.
That was my journey.
Yeah, no, that's lovely. That's exactly the sort of thing. It's not a, you know, surrender sounds like it could be quite a serene process, but it's not. It's exactly like that. I think it's exactly like that. You know, it's like, oh, for God's sake, you know, it's like that.
He knew all the time that I'd got on.
Did he?
Yeah.
Bastard.
Because he didn't find me, anyway, it doesn't matter. But, so he was watching me go through hell.
And he didn't tell you.
Oh.
What a fucker.
Well, God. The boundaries. He had the boundaries.
He had terrible boundaries.
No, this is not. No, there's a whole backstory here that you probably, you might not know about. He has terrible boundaries, though.
No. Yeah, since 1990, and I saw him the other day.
He's
still around.
He's still around
already. Anyway, that's another story.
You can tell me as
well. Okay. Let's have a break for lunch, guys, and let's come back. We're going to come back at 2:15. Have a proper break.